I went into the courtroom and I was sworn in by a man sitting on the other side of the judge, the side I was sitting on. I was eating a piece of candy and chewing on it, and he asked me to spit out my gum, and I said I wasn't chewing any gum. And then I sat down, and then Mr. Kunstler began questioning me, and he asked me about the first times that I had met Jerry Rubin, and I told him that it was in 1964, October of 1964, when I was providing the music for the march on Oakland to end the war in Vietnam, and Jerry Rubin was involved with the Vietnam Day Committee, the VDC it was called. And then we began, I began to talk about how I had met with Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman in a room at the Chelsea Hotel where I was staying with my band in February of 1968. And it was there that we first discussed the implications of a Yippie Festival for Life in Chicago to counteract the Democratic Festival of Death, which was the Democratic Convention being held in Chicago. I was allowed to talk, and I talked for quite a long time about how we felt about the festival, what it would be, whether there were going to be permits in the park or not, what a vicious fascist system existed in America, and how we felt responsible to do something about the oppressive measures of the establishment towards minority groups and about the war in Vietnam. And then I tried to sing my song, The Fixin' to Die Rag, or as it's sometimes known, the Vietnam Rag, and I was stopped by the sergeant of arms, I guess, who came over, and I had closed my eyes, and I was just singing rather loudly, and the judge began yelling at me to stop, and the sergeant of arms came over and tried to close my mouth by putting his hand under my chin. And so then I stopped, and then Mr. Kunstler got permission from the judge for me to say the lyrics of the song, and so then I recited the lyrics of the song, the Fixin' to Die Rag. And then Mr. Kunstler asked me the next time that I had seen Jerry Rubin, and I told him that I'd seen him at the Stony Brook College in New York, where the Yippies had attempted to put on a demonstration there, and Mr. Kunstler asked me if I would describe what happened there, but the prosecuting attorney, Mr. Schultz, objected, and the objection was sustained, and they didn't allow me to talk about what had happened at Stony Brook. Then Mr. Kunstler asked me if when the next time was I had seen Jerry Rubin. I told him that we had met in Jerry Rubin's apartment in the late part of April. And at that time, I had reported to him that young people that I had talked to around the country were not very responsive to the possibilities of having a positive a music festival in Chicago at the time of the Democratic Convention, because everyone was very, very paranoid because of Mayor Daley's shoot-to-kill order concerning the riots in the ghetto, because of rumors of them preparing concentration camps, mobilizing 2,000 vigilante deputies to arrest demonstrators, and preparing the sewers as dungeons to put demonstrators in. We then talked about what positive things could happen at the festival. More entertainers, circus clowns, jugglers, basketball teams, and we discussed the possibilities again of requiring permits for the parks in order to allow everything to happen legally. They said that they were having a little trouble getting the permits, but they probably would get them. Then we discussed. Mr. Kunstler asked me about if I'd been in Chicago, and I told him that I played in the Electric Playground.
Electric Theater.
Electric Theater 3 days before the beginning of the convention, and at that time I saw Jerry Rubin and Abbie Hoffman, and I informed them that I was withdrawing my support and the support of my band from the festival, and withdrawing our participation from the festival because of the rather obvious threats of violence around the convention and the festival. Then I attempted to describe what happened to me after it was after I had played at the Electric Theater and was going home, and Mr. Schultz objected, but then the objection was sustained by the judge. No, the objection was overruled by the judge, and I told how I had been attacked by three guys in a hotel lobby along with my organ player, David Cohen, and my nose was fractured, and I had to go to the hospital to have it fixed, and then the next day we left. Then I was cross-examined by Mr. Schultz, the assistant prosecuting attorney. All the time that I was testifying, the prosecuting attorney's name is
Fran.
Yeah. Was glaring at me, a very vicious, cold sort of expression on his face, almost sneering, and Mr. Schultz got up and tried to attempt to get me to indirectly make statements which would help his case, such as, did Abbie Hoffman tell you that he had said that there was going to be a violent confrontation with the police? And my answer being no or yes would affirm that there was a possibility that Abbie Hoffman had at some time actually said that. He attempted to ask me whether I had known that Abbie Hoffman said that people were going to fornicate in the park. I refused to answer these questions because they were misleading. I was told to answer. I finally had to answer no. Then he attempted to, for some reason, to get me to say that some of the performers that I had talked to about playing in Chicago had wanted money for their playing there, but I kept asking him to rephrase his question, and then eventually he just gave up, and that was the end of our questioning. Well, in the beginning of the trial, I was asked by Mr. Kunstler what I did for a living, and I listed many things, because I do many things. Help to produce records, record records, perform in a rock band, perform as a single artist, act in movies, act in television. I'm a minister for the New Universal Life Church. I'm a father, a husband, a poet, author. And as I was listing out these things, he whispered that I was a jerk. At least that's what I'm told.
Well, I came in as a defense witness and finally went on the stand on about mid-afternoon. And the things that Bill Kunstler wanted to question me about were mainly my connection and participation in the mobilization activities starting back in, or at the time of the April 67 demonstration at the UN in New York, and then right on up to the present time. I'm Stuart Meacham, and I'm the Peace Education Secretary of the American Friends Service Committee, and I'm now one of the co-chairmen of the the new mold. And so he started then questioning me about the April 15 thing and also the October 21 thing at the Pentagon. And every question that he would ask me practically, except my name, Foran, the top lawyer for the government, would jump up and object, and the judge would sustain the objection just almost automatically. The thing that really surprised me was when we got to the October 21 thing at the Pentagon, I had known that there had been a good deal of testimony about that that had been entered into the record already by some of the prosecution witnesses that were, you know, trying to lay a groundwork for trying to prove that the manner and the style and the basic motivation of the leadership of the Chicago thing as far back as then had been violent and obstructionist. And I was quite willing to, you know, testify as to what I had observed, not only in meetings when the October thing was being planned, but also when I was there and saw it. But every question that Bill Kunstler would ask me, Foran would jump up and object, and the judge would just automatically sustain the objection. So finally, we got on over into 1968 at a couple of meetings that I attended, one on February 11 here in Chicago, and one in March at Camp Villa, when plans were being made for the Chicago action. And even that was almost as vigorously cut off as far as any testimony was concerned by Foran's objections and the judge sustaining him. At one time, the judge cut in and gave me a lecture because I was calling Dave Dellinger Dave rather than calling him Mr. Dellinger. And he told me I should call him Mr. Dellinger or David Dellinger. He was a very strange kind of a judge. That was about the way the thing went. I had a very strong impression that he was not anxious, really, to know what I knew or to hear what I had to say. And certainly the prosecution wasn't. They didn't want to hear any testimony about my own basic attitudes and beliefs. At one time, Bill Kunstler introduced a paper that Tom Hayden and Rennie Davis had prepared for the Camp Villa meeting, and it was distributed there. And it was a proposal about the for the kind of action and the tone and the character of the action that they thought ought to occur in Chicago during the Democratic Convention. And there was one, it was a very good paper. It's actually, I reread it before I went on the stand. I was very much impressed with it all over again. I'd first seen it at the time of the Camp Villa meeting. And it had a section in it that stated very clearly that the action should be nonviolent and legal and all of that. And Bill Kunstler wanted to get that introduced into the record as a part of this planning meeting in August when the Chicago action was being planned. And so he asked me if I'd seen the document before and had read it. And at that point, the Foran objected again, and he wanted to read the whole document. Well, it's about 21 pages, and they took out 45 minutes while he read it. And then when we got back in, he objected to it being introduced on the ground that it was written by Tom and Rennie rather than by me. Well, he could have told that the first 2 minutes, you know. But and the judge immediately sustained the objection. And then Bill Kunstler said, well, suppose, he said, this is an important document to our case. It shows the motivation of two of the defendants and their analysis and what they were wanting to plan. And if I can't introduce it now, and suppose we have Rennie Davis or Tom Hayden on the stand, and I try to introduce it then, will you sustain an objection by the government on the ground that it's self-serving? Well, the judge said, that's irrelevant. Let's go on. I don't know whether they'll ever get that document introduced or not, but that sort of is an example of the kind of of difficulty that the defense, it seems to me, runs into in getting any kind of information on the stand. Then when I was finally on this morning to conclude my testimony, they asked me about events that I had observed here in Chicago during the Democratic Convention. I got out here late. I got here only on Thursday of that week and arrived at Grant Park that afternoon at about the time that Dave Dellinger was announcing that the activities of the national mobilization for the week in Chicago were now being concluded. He made that announcement out in the park that afternoon. And I happened to walk up just as I heard Dave making that announcement. Well, I testified to that. And then on cross-examination, Foran would say, "Did you hear Tom Hayden say that we must smash the fascist pigs?" I would say, "No, I didn't hear anybody say that, Tom or anybody else. Did you say so-and-so say this?" He would go through this long catalog of things, you know, that he wanted to know whether I'd heard. Well, I'd already told him that the only thing I'd heard Tom, Rennie, or Dave say was just this last statement I heard Dave say, and the rest was just greeting them. But he wanted to list a long catalog of bad things that he was hoping, you know, he knew I hadn't heard them, but he wanted to say them again so that apparently these were things that somebody had already said they'd said, and he wanted to say them again so the jury would have these things planted in their minds. And then one of the last things he asked me about, I'd testified earlier that at this February 11 meeting here in Chicago, a number of people had been present, and among those I listed were Charlene Mitchell, who had been the presidential candidate of the Communist Party in the fall elections in 68. And he asked me, he said, "Did Charlene, you said you testified that she was at the meeting?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Did she run for public office?" And I said, "Yes, I understand she did." And he said, "What office was it?" I said, "Well, you know, I can't really clearly remember." And I really couldn't. I wasn't dead sure whether it was for president or for vice president. But I said it was one of the two. And he said, "And what party was that?" And I said, "The Communist Party." So he said, "That's all." And that was about the level that he seemed to be casting his whole case. At one time just earlier, during the direct examination, I had mentioned the fact that I had gone to Hanoi to bring back some pilots from Hanoi, and that Tom and Rennie Davis had had a role in getting, you know, asking me if I would go, selecting who would go, and then I'd talked with Tom some about the whole trip in Paris on our way to Hanoi. And so he asked me, he said, "You mentioned the National Liberation Front." This was Foran, the prosecuting lawyer. He said, "You mentioned the National Liberation Front. Is that commonly called the Viet Cong?" I said, "Well, I always call it the National Liberation Front." He said, "But don't a lot of people call it the Viet Cong?" And I said, "Well, the judge reprimanded me the other day for calling Dave Dellinger Dave, and he wanted me to use the correct name of everything. So I was using the correct name of this, the National Liberation Front." And the judge got all excited then, you know, and he wanted the question read back, said, "Is this sometimes called the National, the Viet Cong?" And I said, "Yes, it sometimes is, but I always say the National Liberation Front because that's the correct name." Then he wanted to know, he said, "You referred to the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. Is that also sometimes called the Hanoi government or the North Vietnam government?" And I said, "Well, I guess it is. I sometimes call it the Hanoi government or the North Vietnam government, and but I generally call it the Democratic Republic of Vietnam." Well, that was the level he was casting the whole thing on, and obviously to attempt to create some sort of apprehension in the minds of the jurors that there's something sinister and leftist and communistic about anybody who believes that it's wrong to try people for conspiracy because they're against the war. I sat there and it just seemed to me that it's a strange kind of thing in this very criminal and atrocious war that the only people that are being tried for crimes in connection with it are people that are for peace. And the real war criminals, the people who have committed the crimes against humanity and the crimes against peace and who have set the policies and devised the weapons that have created the Songhees, nobody even thinks about trying them for their war crimes. And this trial, it seems to me, is a perfect example not only of how the courts and the Congress has been taken over and not only how the national elections and the Congress have been taken over, but also how the courts have been.
And today you were put on the witness stand by the defense in the conspiracy trial. Briefly, could you relate the type of knowledge that was extracted from you today in court?
Well, I was good at babbling about meetings in the past with Abby and Jerry, like the famous meeting at the St. Mark's Baths, where Jerry Rubin and I drafted the Yippie fundraising letter, clad in terry cloth kilts and eating psilocybin sponge cake in late March 68. And I was generally good at denying the prosecution contention that Abby and Jerry had publicly and vociferously indicated that there would be incredible violence, or that violence was a direct scheme or plan of the Yippies and the people that were planning the various activities of the Festival of Life.
How did the prosecution, how did the government react to your testimony?
Well, they liked all the smut, it seemed. I mean, the guy kept asking me about, I had one schema I had written for the underground papers in on August 7th and 8th that indicated a poetic format of the Yippie demonstrations in the event that there were no permits. And one of the paragraphs said that there would be public fornication wherever there's a willing aperture and an aroused appendage. And Schultz, blushing like a Fordham law student, came, on the cross-examination, was very excited. Seemed to be very excited about that, and wanted to know wanted to know how that related to Yippie myth. And then I told him that, well, it really didn't, because the last public fornication was when the armies of Alexander the Great had public fornication celebrating Alexander the Great's marriage to a Babylonian princess.
How do you feel Judge Hoffman and the jury reacted to your testimony, particularly when Schultz tried to bring out all the smut involved within the Yippie myth?
Well, the jury, they certainly were prepared for it. I mean, they certainly showed no surprise, although it woke some of them up. You know, it's like a psychic alarm clock, when they hear a four-letter word attacks the subconscious, and evidently, and it wakes a lot of them up, as though the dream state wakes them up. But it was interesting. I don't know. We always like to be a juror, trapped without cultural sustenance for 4 months, listening to a Hoffmanian nightmare,
How did Julius the Just seem to react to your testimony?
He kept asking me if I had any smut. He was very nervous, always twittering and twatting, and when I'd read something, he would sigh occasionally as I read, because I tried to read slow and with a certain amount of articulation. So he would cluck and sigh and wince and tap his footstool and shift around and make notes. But it generally seemed to leave me alone, I mean, I didn't have any hassles with him, really, in that I was able to testify along most of the lines I wanted to, and I really didn't have any confrontation with him to speak of. He kind of left me alone. Why, I don't know,
Many of the questions directed to you by attorney Leonard Weinglass for the defense were objected to by the government. One would almost feel that the government objected to them solely because they felt that the defense win its case.
Right. Well, they did not want me to indicate in the dealings I had with Jerry and Abby for me to indicate that there was absolutely no violence planned for the Democratic Convention, which is the only contention of the prosecution is that Jerry and Abby went around saying, on the one hand, let's have Festival Life, and on the other hand, let's kick ass, and that really didn't happen, you know. And that Jerry and Abby never discussed buttock breaking. Only we're discussing a Festival Life and rock and guerrilla theater, etc.
Do you feel that what happened in court today to you and to your testimony? Do you feel that that changed your awareness of the American judicial system?
Well, it shows. It does speak something for this type of trial. I mean, it certainly must be a way of enacting justice without all this. It was like a leukemia ward or something. I mean, it was just like this sustained pain evident in the face of the jurors, and this sustained, debilitating aura of creepiness that just bounced off the walls in ceaseless droning and droning and droning. It was like a drone. It's like, God, some satanic harmonium droning away in the brain. It was terrible.
When you first, you know, began to work on the Festival of Life, early 1968, did you feel that the government would go to such outrageous ends to put its organizers in jail?
Well, no, one never thought that there would be an outcome. You know, until March 21st, when Johnson abdicated, it was obvious that it was just going to be a big shoe-in for Johnson, and that it would be. And I think that had Johnson run, there would have been a big, huge demonstration like the Pentagon, and everything would be cooled out. But because Humphrey was listening to all those creepo liberals like Abe Fortas and others, I believe along with Tom Hayden, that there was an overt decision by Democratic Party liberal types to stomp out the demonstrators so that Humphrey could counterbalance the claims of Nixon that they would be soft on law and order. And I tend to agree with that, you know. I think it's all the Democratic Party did it. And now the trial is an act of vengeance enacted by the Democratic Party enacted through daily, I guess, in the Justice Department, the Democrats in the Justice Department. I don't know what I'm saying, but I feel it, you know. I feel it's vengeance.
My name is Paul Krasner, and I just finished testifying at the conspiracy trial, and I plead guilty. Because that's the truth, because I'm as guilty or as innocent as those who, you know, the particular spectrum of scapegoats who are on trial. It's just that arbitrary. My particular motivation was just to have them not cross-examine me because it couldn't accomplish anything, and to get the Catholic priest on after me.
And I'll tell you very frankly what my feeling on Chicago was. I had a feeling it was going to be a very bad deal. And I stayed away, thought it over very carefully, and stayed away because I felt that at the time that I would be perfectly safe because of my clerical garb and my age. And I would be, in a sense, leading young people into situations where they would not be safe and they would be hit, and I wouldn't do it. As it turned out, I would not have been safe, you see.
Had you known that, you might have come.
I well might have come had I known the how berserk they were going to get.
Many people feel that the police action during the Democratic Convention, the conspiracy indictments, and the murder of Fred Hampton and other Panthers signals a new era of repression in this country. Do you think this is true?
I don't think it's any change. We've always, it's bad, but it's been bad. It was very bad in the 30s, right here in Chicago. At least they didn't kill anybody in 68, and in the 30s, the Memorial Day massacre, was that 38? I guess it was. They killed many people, same police force. It was much worse deal. And they killed black and white, and that time mostly white. They killed and beat and clubbed them, and the women were hurt too. That was a vicious, wild, and the history of our country has not. We are not a peace-loving, freedom-loving country. I mean, we are just doing as we've done.
In terms of systematic violence, do you think the anti-riot law being tested out in the conspiracy trial establishes the legal basis for a police state?
You don't need it. If the sentiment grows for a police state, we'll have it, regardless of the law. We'll have it. The law... is the law any worse than the Smith Act, any worse than the things we did in the McCarthy stuff and McCarthy era? But the thing that I see, I see no diminution of the in the forces that are against the police state.
Now, is that different from other?
Yeah, decades? They're better. They're more. There's more opposition to it, and more intelligent opposition to it, and a broader base to the opposition to it than we ever had in the past.
Okay.